Hi everyone, and welcome to New Books in National Security. I'm Paul, the host of the channel. Today we'll be chatting with Mr. Phil Gursky, a lifelong professional in the Canadian security and intelligence world, and now the CEO of Borealis Threat and Risk Consulting. He's also the author of the forthcoming The Threat from Within, Recognizing Al-Qaeda-Inspired Radicalization and Terrorism in the West. The book is published by Roman and Littlefield. Hi Phil, and welcome to New Books in National Security. We're so pleased to have you here today to talk about your book.
Great to be here.
Thanks, Phil. Maybe you can start us off with a little bit just about yourself and how you came to get into this field.
Sure. So I recently retired from the Canadian Public Service after 32 years. Moved to Ottawa from my home in London, Ontario back in 1983, probably well before you were born, and joined Communication Security Establishment as a multilingual analyst. Spent 17 and a half years there before moving on to this Canadian Security Intelligence Service, where I became a sort of a specialist slash expert in radicalization and homegrown Islamist extremism, and spent 13 and a half years with CSIS before moving on to Public Safety Canada, where I was a strategic advisor on Canada's countering violent extremism policy. And then in April of this year, I decided enough was enough and decided to retire, partly in order to be able to publish my book, because as you can imagine, working in a security intelligence field, publishing is rather frowned upon.
Absolutely. Did you have to get clearance with your former organizations to publish this, or were they pretty hands-off about it?
There's a requirement that whenever you have access to classified material at any point in your career, that you have to have any possible publications vetted for betraying secrets or saying things that they don't want you to say. So I did submit the manuscript to CSIS, and to my great surprise and great contentment, they didn't change one comma. So I was able to use nothing but open source material and then give my spin on things based on my experiences with the organization.
That's great. That's great. So how did you come to begin work specifically on the threat from within? Did you just have a lot of ideas from your time in the public service that you felt like you wanted to express? Or was there something specific catalyst?
A bit of both, actually. So I began looking at the threat within Canada from what we call homegrown Islamist extremism back in about 2002. And as the years went on, I was exposed to more and more cases, all of which are quite famous in Canada. Moman Khawaja back in 2004, the Toronto 18 back in 2006, et cetera, et cetera. And I began to ask questions about why and how and where people were becoming radicalized. And the more knowledge I gained, the more I began to get a better idea as to what this phenomenon was all about. And all my colleagues kept saying, you got to write a book about this someday. And so I had it in the back of my mind. And what I did is I started to collect open source material, because once these cases became public through the court system and you have testimony, you have court cases, a lot of the so-called intelligence becomes evidence and is disclosed in open court. So I was able to collect all this material over years. And then about 2 years ago, I started to start thinking about putting it together into a book. It all sort of came to a glorious head about a year ago, and it was ready for publication as of last November. So in ways, it was about 12 years in the making, but sort of came together in about a 12 to 18 month period.
Fascinating. So early on in the book, getting into the book itself, you note this prevalent idea that we're faced with a new scourge, and I'm quoting here, a new scourge of virtually undetectable individuals who are radicalized to the point of violence on their own and then go on to commit acts of terrorism. So you take this idea and you unpack it as being flawed on several different fronts. Maybe you can explain where you see fault with this notion.
So there's a publicly accepted idea that people who become terrorists come from specific backgrounds. So, for example, terrorists are all marginalized people, or terrorism spreads from poverty, or terrorism spreads from mental illness, for example. And what I've shown is that, at least from a Canadian perspective, looking at the cases here in Canada, that doesn't ring true most of the time. Most of the people that radicalize to violence are actually middle class or upper middle class, generally university educations, generally no criminal backgrounds, generally integrated, whatever we measure as integrated, it's a very complex term. Most are married and or significant relationships, and those who are married have children. So you're looking actually at what we would define as a successful population. So it's a myth that the ones that become terrorists are the losers and that they seek out terrorism because there's nothing else in their lives. In actual fact, in many cases, they're very successful people. Moman Khawaja had a college degree, was working for Foreign Affairs Canada when he was arrested. One of the Toronto 18 was a computer programmer, making a six-figure salary driving a BMW. Mm-hmm. Shehab Esagayer, who was just sentenced to life today, was actually a brilliant PhD student. Mm-hmm. And I like to joke that if he hadn't chosen door two and become a terrorist, he would have been a very brilliant biologist somewhere mm-hmm. in a lab in the world. So there are enough counterexamples to the public myth that these people are all destined to become terrorists, to fill some kind of aching void in their life, to show that, in fact, that's not the case.
Absolutely. One of the elements of the book that will likely make it appealing to a practitioner audience, as opposed to academia, is your focus on the what of violent radicalization, as opposed to the why. So going back to the same question, why did you choose to focus your writing on the question of what makes a terrorist?
A couple of reasons. First and foremost, the why question is probably unanswerable in the sense that you can probably determine why a particular individual goes down a pathway mm-hmm. should you have enough information, background, past activities, influences, etc. But you can't make any general conclusions. So it almost gets to the point where there are as many whys as there are people. So there are no grand trends to talk about why. So if we can't talk about why, in the sense that we can't generalize it to be of any use to anyone, because I think the question is, can we come up with a system that helps your so-called first responders, your teachers, your parents, your religious leaders, your security intelligence folks, your law enforcement, to preemptively identify people? And I like to joke in the book, this isn't Minority Report, where you have some woman in a pool somewhere who predicts future criminality. You can't do that. So if you can't look at why, you look at how or what. And that was done deliberately because we know what. And we know what because of hundreds of cases that we've looked at. Secondly, the book was written explicitly with first responders in mind. So it's not an academic tome. I'm not an academic. I'm a intelligence analyst of long standing. And it was geared at law enforcement. It was geared at parents, mentors, religious leaders, teachers, social workers, law enforcement, people who would be in a position to identify individuals showing signs of violent radicalization so that they can take action, be it intervention, mm-hmm. be it investigation, be it arrests, be it laying of charges, whatever is specific to that particular case. You can't do that unless you have the information. Mm-hmm. And one thing that struck me, the more and more stories I read in the open media about individuals who, let's say, gone to Syria to join the Islamic State or planned acts of terrorism in here in Canada or in the West, is that everyone kept saying they never saw it coming. And the more I read, as the story unfolds, I'm thinking, well, how did you not see it coming? Because all the signs are there. So the point was is that you don't know what to look for if you don't understand the phenomenon. And so the purpose of the book in large part is to say, here's what you have to look for. If you see these particular behaviors or these particular attitudes, they're not predictive that someone's going to go boom tomorrow. But what they are is they are worrisome in the sense that they have to be questioned. They have to be not necessarily investigated from a law enforcement perspective. They have to be delved into to determine what's happening. Is it serious? Is it a joke? Is it a passing fad? That they can't be ignored. In too many cases, they're ignored. And people either don't take action, or as we saw in the case of Michael Zahaf Thibault, who was the parliament terrorist last October, he was exhibiting behaviors in a mosque on the West Coast. Mm-hmm. And the mosque reaction, which is understandable to an extent, was simply to kick him out. They didn't call anybody. They didn't seek assistance. They said, we don't like what you're saying. You're not consistent with our brand of Islam. Therefore, get out. And of course, we know what happened is that he ended up coming back across the country and killing Nathan Cirillo on October 22nd last mm-hmm. year.
After the attacks that you mentioned last October in Canada, much was made of the potential mental illness suffered by the perpetrators. Can you discuss the rhetorical mm-hmm. as well as the actual role that mental illness plays in terrorism, but also in the public discourse that surrounds terrorism?
It's a huge issue, and it has not been resolved yet. I think we're still understanding it. I think that people have a knee-jerk reaction to conclude that all terrorists are crazy. Why would someone strap on a suicide vest? Mm-hmm. Why would someone running to Parliament with a shotgun, knowing full well they're going to be killed within seconds once they sort of breach that barrier. Normal people wouldn't do these types of things. Therefore, they must be crazy. In actual fact, the literature that's out there, which isn't all that robust, shows quite categorically they're not crazy. There's a few problems with it. Very few of them are actually diagnosed. So we don't have a medical diagnosis that says you have condition X, Y, or Z. But what is out there shows that, in fact, they certainly have views that are different from the mainstream, but they're not mentally ill.
Mm-hmm.
They may have mental issues, but I would counter who doesn't.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we all have issues of some form or another. But there's nothing to suggest in the literature that they're mentally ill. I think that the mental illness or crazy label serves as a kind of a comfort for us, because if we conclude that they're crazy, then we somehow push them into a corner. They're not like us. Nothing you can do about it. You have to simply hospitalize them, get them help. You can't explain it. You can't understand it. You can't rationalize it. It's harder if you understand, if you accept the reality that in fact, they're cut from the Canadian cloth or UK cloth or US cloth. They come from society. We saw the most recent case in Toronto that, again, the life sentences were announced yesterday. One of the terrorists, Shehabis Aghaier, the Tunisian PhD student, was deemed schizophrenic by one of the psychiatrists who examined him after he had already been found guilty in the first trial. I argued in my blog that I'm not a psychiatrist. He may, in fact, be schizophrenic, but his behavior, to me, strikes me as radical behavior, not mentally ill behavior. So it is really hard. I would suggest that 1 in 5 Canadians suffers from a mental illness, according to the CMHA. Why would we expect anything more from our terrorists? So maybe 20% of terrorists are mentally ill.
Sure.
But again, there's absolutely no evidence in the literature, be it academic or whatever's been released from security intelligence services, to suggest that mental illness plays a major role. And in fact, historically, you saw that organized groups would not avail themselves of mentally ill people because they can't be trusted. They're not predictable. They need, if you're going to send someone to let off a suicide vest and he's mentally ill, you're not sure what his reaction is going to be. You need someone that's going to pull the plunger or press the plunger, pull the cord, whatever, and carry out the act. You don't need someone that's going to go and react in an unpredictable way once the attack is supposed to happen. So I think the bottom line is we don't know. We'll probably never know because it's really hard to interview successful suicide bombers. A lot of the evidence is anecdotal. It's not medical in nature. And I'm not sure it really makes a difference at this point. If we were to find out it were slightly higher than the norm, what would that get us? It would still show that the vast majority are not mentally ill. So again, is it to comfort us that these people are different? I'm not really sure. So more work needs to be done, but it'll be a very challenging form of work to be done. And I've noticed that a lot of the so-called mentally ill diagnoses don't take into account radicalization, and that just because they think differently, they see spirits, they're called jinn in Arabic, therefore they're mentally ill. Well, people talk to angels all the time. Does that mean that people that talk to angels are mentally ill? So there are certain aspects that are foreign to us because they're foreign culturally, they're foreign historically, they're foreign linguistically. We don't understand them, and then we put them in that mentally ill box, and that's not very helpful at all.
Later in the book, you helpfully outline a number of key concepts from Islamic history that underlie what you describe as the Al-Qaeda narrative. Mm-hmm. Can you discuss just a few of kind of the most important concepts that stem from Islamic history that Al-Qaeda has latched on to?
Sure.
and used to spread its narrative?
Sure. They're the obvious ones, like jihad, and we can talk about jihad for hours, so I'll sort of just park them onto the side. There's a notion that the Islamic State especially has latched on to recently, and it's the notion of hijra, which is Arabic for emigration. And it refers to the time in Islamic history where the Prophet Muhammad left Mecca for Medina because he was being persecuted. So he migrated, he performed hijra from Mecca to Medina. What the Islamic State has done is kind of warped it in a way and said, if you're living in the West, you can't be a true Muslim because the West hates Islam. As the narrative says, the West is at war with Islam, and you must perform hijra to an Islamic State. Traditionally, that would have been Saudi Arabia or Cairo or Egypt, rather. Of course, today the Islamic State sees itself as the pinnacle of Islam, so they're saying, perform hijra, come here. And in jihadi literature, you see a nexus between hijra and jihad. So they say, first of all, get yourself out of the West, get yourself to a true Islamic country, and once you're there, you can perform jihad, engage with other groups. Another aspect that a lot of the groups are very angry about is the notion of bid'ah, which means innovation or change. What these conservative groups and extremist groups argue is that Islam has been around for the better part of about 1400 years. And they say that the only true Islam was the Islam of the first few generations. So the Prophet Muhammad and the first four successors called the rightly guided caliphs. Anything after that is change, is aberration, is innovation, is wrong. And so what these groups argue is that, in fact, you have to get rid of all, basically, 1,350 years of development, of exegesis, of theological arguments, of developments in faith, Islamic jurisprudence called fiqh. And you have to throw all that out because it doesn't correspond to the true Islam of the early part of the 7th century AD. So what that does, in fact, is it marginalizes a huge amount of Islamic history. And more importantly, it marginalizes certain groups, such as the Shia, such as the Sufis, such as the Ahmadis from the 19th century, because they were born from innovation, they were born from change, and they're not true Muslims. Therefore, they can be targeted and they can be eliminated because they basically don't conform to what Islam should all be about. Another part, of course, is martyrdom, which I think is largely misunderstood in the West. Everyone talks about the virgins. It's not about the virgins. There are rewards in paradise for martyrs, which includes gaining paradise, which includes having your sins forgiven. And to me, most importantly, and this is often underreported, is that if you die a martyr, you also can intercede on behalf of 70 of your family once you get to paradise, and they'll gain paradise when they die as well. Another one they talk about a lot is called shirk, which means associating others with God. In other words, polytheism. So, of course, Christianity is polytheistic. There's the Trinity in Christianity. They accuse the Shia of being polytheist because they elevate Ali and his wife Fatima to a level a little higher than humans. And they're big on, you know, there's one God, only one God, no three persons, no one can associate with God. And anyone who does that, in fact, is practicing a false religion. And they will say, well, there's only one true religion, which everyone must abide by. Several scholars and extremist ideologues over the centuries have pointed out that Islam is the only religion. Others will follow it by force if necessary, because it was determined that Islam was for all people. So these concepts, I think, are really, really important because they don't get a lot of play in the press. They are difficult to understand, again, linguistically, culturally, historically. But if you don't understand those concepts, you can't understand the groups that are basing their ideology and their practices on those concepts.
I think the concept of takfir, too, is playing a really important role, not only in the Islamic State's view of other Muslims and the West, but in the rift between Al-Qaeda and the Islamic State. And, okay, who can say who is a takfir or an apostate?
Exactly.
And what does that let you justify?
Exactly. It's a huge issue. And, you know, the vast majority of Muslims would say this is bogus.
Mm-hmm.
No one has the right. In fact, there's a verse in the Quran or one of the hadith that says Allah alone will determine who's Muslim or who's a believer and who's not. Who are you to make Allah's decision for him? So takfirism basically is the declaration that someone is not a believer. And as you mentioned, it goes well beyond just Christians and Jews and Hindus and Buddhists and non-Muslims. It goes to the very heart of Islam, where the extremists will say, we are the true representatives of Islam. We are the only veritable ones. We are the ones that have kept the faith original and pure. The rest of you are all basically kuffar. You are unbelievers. Mm-hmm. And what they do is they lower the other Muslims to the same level as non-Muslims. And this is why you're seeing a lot of intra-Muslim violence in places like Pakistan, mm-hmm. In Syria and Iraq, in other parts of the world, because the extremists have taken upon themselves to determine who's a true Muslim and who's not. Mm-hmm. And if you're not a true Muslim, then you must die.
Mm-hmm. Moving on, chapter 3, I think, is going to be of great interest to some of our listeners who are professionals in this field. What were some of the observable behaviors and attitudes that we're likely to see among radicalizing extremists?
Right. As you said, I mean, I really wrote the book with chapter 3 in mind. The whole point was to get information into the hands of people who were in a position to detect people who were, in fact, exhibiting behaviors that were radical in nature. In some ways, it was the easiest chapter to write. In some ways, it was the most difficult chapter to write. Easiest in the sense that there are behaviors, and I'll get to that in a second. Hardest in the sense that I'm still very worried that people take this as a checklist and see that, okay, if person exhibits 6 out of 12 or 8 out of 12, then, you know, call 911. You know, the bomb's about to go off. And as I stress throughout the chapter, these are guides. These behaviors and attitudes are consistent with people who've gone on to commit acts of terrorism or join terrorist groups such as the Islamic State. They're not guarantees. And one of the challenges that we faced when I worked at CSIS were the people who exhibited all the behaviors but never did anything. We call them couch jihadis. They're also called wannabes or called whatever. So the behaviors are consistent with outcomes, but they're not predictors of outcomes. So the whole point of the indicators is to provide information to those that need it. As I mentioned, it's the frontline people, the families, the religious leaders, the teachers, the law enforcement. So that when they see these things, they know they're problematic. They know that they should be looked into. Not necessarily full-blown investigations, not necessarily arrests, but that questions should be asked so that we're not left with a situation where somebody ends up dying or joining the Islamic State and the family says, we never saw it coming. It's been my experience that these behaviors are overt. They're in plain sight. They're not hidden. And we're not talking about sleeper cells here, like the old Soviet sleeper cells that did nothing for 30 years. I think there are reasons why they're overt and observable. But the whole point is that people will see them in a certain environment. So the behaviors range from, the indicators range from behaviors to attitudes. So some of the behaviors would involve, for example, a sudden change in social milieu. So a person has a group of friends, and then all of a sudden there's a complete break with one's past. They take up with new friends. The new friends are all extremists as well. You'll see behaviors where they become very critical of families, family practices. The family isn't Muslim enough. Sisters aren't wearing the hijab, therefore they're sluts, they're prostitutes, that kind of thing. Some of the ideologies refer to some of the stuff I've already talked about, a hatred and intolerance for other attitudes. So they will see other Muslims as kuffar, okay? They'll see Christians and Jews as not valid people. They'll be very critical of Western society, democracy, gender equality, same-sex, things like that. And they'll say this is inimical to Islam and its interests. An obsession with extremist sites. I remember reading a case recently in Kenya where this kid was on 14 hours a day on jihadi sites. That's a lot of time to be spending online. Obviously, association with like-minded people. Again, it has to do with that change in social milieu, an obsession with groups and conflicts abroad. Again, and this is one where you have to be careful. Being concerned about Syria is not a crime. In fact, we should be concerned about Syria. Where it becomes problematic is where your concern is not for Syria. Your interest is in joining Jabhat al-Nusra or joining the Islamic State or one of the other groups that's fighting in Syria. And, of course, the obsession with jihad and martyrdom and, interestingly, an obsession with the end of history because the Islamic State, in fact, parades the fact that it is going to usher in the end of the world through this apocalyptic scenario which dates from early days of Islam and has parallels in Christianity and Judaism. The interesting part is that people have traveled to go fight in Syria because they do believe the world's coming to an end. And if I'm going to give up my life, what better place to do it in the great cosmic battle between good and evil in which good wins and everyone becomes happy. So again, the behaviors, they're there. They are overt. They are concrete. They are observable. And all I'm saying is that take note of them. See what's really going on in the environment. Don't rely on them as predictors. They're not predictive in nature. You don't add them up and give them scores. They are just things that should give you pause to ask questions. I'm also contending that the behaviors will be present in most cases. It has been my experience that they won't show all. Each person won't show all 12, but they'll show most of them. Because these are in a sense a package, and they are a package because they basically fall out of the ideology. The ideology is rejectionist. It is hateful. It is intolerant. So that's where you get the intolerance of other Muslims, of Christians, of Jews, of Canadian foreign policy, of Canadian ways of doing things. And then there's a religious aspect as well, which people really are very nervous about talking. But there is a religious aspect to it. It's a religion of jihad. It's a religion of martyrdom. It's a religion of the end of time. There are religious aspects that we can't ignore. But we get really antsy talking about them because people say, oh, you're just being Islamophobic. You're being anti-Muslim. No, we're not. We're simply saying that the groups are successfully, because they're recruiting, and as we've seen, there's tens of thousands fighting with the Islamic State right now from the West. The groups are successfully using religion as a pull factor to get them to go travel over there.
Mm-hmm. I think one of the reasons that the book is so topical is because the problem is really so difficult. And you identify before that these might be a package of behaviors that some people could have some or all of, and yet still do nothing. But those people are still surely going to be of concern to security agencies, who will have to then watch them very, very carefully. And I imagine the resources involved in that can be extremely extensive. And then when you look at the situation with the Islamic State, countries like France having potentially thousands of their citizens going overseas and having to figure out which of those thousands are likely to return and which among the returnees are likely to commit acts of violence.
You're absolutely right. The resource cost is tremendous, and no country has the resources in place. The head of MI5 just admitted that they're looking at 3,000 people in the UK. MI5 is about the same size as CSIS. UK is about twice the population of Canada, but there's no way that a security service of a few thousand people can watch 3,000 people. You mentioned France. Belgium has the highest per capita of any country fighting the Islamic State right now of its citizens. The problem is that the security services, be they law enforcement or intelligence, have to do due diligence. They have to look at these people because there are no models that say, this is the guy that's going to do it. Now, Thomas Hegghammer, who's a very well-respected Norwegian scholar on Islamist extremism, has studied it historically, and he says that approximately 1 in 9 people who fight abroad or train come home to carry out attacks in their native countries. And that, and I'm, Thomas is an amazing scholar, and I have a great deal of respect for him. That's fine, but okay, you have 20,000, at least 20,000 foreigners fighting with the Islamic State. So say 1 in 10 is likely to carry out an attack once they get back. That's 2,000 people. Now, okay, spread out over a number of countries, you're still looking at, you know, let's say, for example, the UK says it has 500 people thereabouts who've gone to fight the Islamic State. So 50, they have to worry about 50 people upon their return. We know from how many resources it takes to carry out investigations, you're talking hundreds of people per investigation if it ramps up to the point of attack planning. Toronto 18, the plot in Victoria, the plot in the Via Passenger plot, these are resource-intensive investigations, both in terms of manpower, in terms of money, in terms of time. The security services cannot a priori eliminate people saying, oh, he's not going to do anything. And we've had, you know, the unfortunate reality of last October, the attack that gets less attention is the attack which took place on October the 20th in Saint-Jean-sur-Richelieu in Quebec. And Martin Couture-Rouleau, who was a convert, he wanted to join the Islamic State. His passport had been seized. He couldn't leave the country. A few weeks before his attack, he was actually spoken to by both law enforcement and religious authorities, and he had told them that he had changed his mind. This was no longer of any interest to him. He wasn't keen to go and actually fight for a terrorist group. And a few weeks later, he got in a car and he ran over two Canadian officers. So what that shows is that even if you put surveillance in place, even if you put your investigations in place, that's no guarantee that you're actually going to be able to stop something. You know, our security services are amazing. They do an incredible job. They're not perfect and never will be, because you're talking about, you're reduced to individual decision-making. And I'm not a psychologist, but I've seen nothing to suggest we can predict decision-making, even in laboratory conditions, let alone in the real world where it's a lot more messy. So we're going to have a bunch of radicalized people, the vast majority of whom will never do anything, but they still take resources to the point where you have, and at what point do you say, okay, we've investigated this, we're going to eliminate it as a priority? Again, recent history shows us that if you do that, and understand why you do it, because you can't watch everyone forever, given limited resources, things can go very badly. And the leader of the 7-7 plot in the UK was deemed to be a second priority by the security service. Not being critical of MI5, you're looking at 3,000 people. You can't watch them all at the same time. You prioritize. Muhammad Siddiqui Khan was believed to be a lesser priority. He was leader of the attack in 2005 that killed 50 people and you know, injured 700.
Yeah, it's an extremely difficult area. Chapter 4 goes on to summarize some of the major terrorism cases in Canada since 9/11. Since many of our listeners are probably not Canadians, I was hoping you could maybe discuss these cases as they pertain to your book's core message.
Sure. So the first real case, I think, that had a real Canadian angle to it that I discussed in the book was back in 2004 when a young man called Moman Khawaja, who was born and raised in Ottawa, middle-class home, a college-educated computer programmer, was arrested for his participation in a fertilizer plot in the United Kingdom called Operation Crevice by MI5. He was kind of the poster child of how can a kid born with not quite a silver spoon in his mouth, but born with all the advantages, go down the terrorism pathway. And he was also the first case to go before the courts under the Anti-Terrorism Act, which was passed in the wake of 9/11. So that was basically set a precedent for the Canadian legal system as to how can you prosecute a terrorism case, the whole problem of intelligence versus evidence and things like that. So he was successfully prosecuted and found guilty in 2008. A lot of Canadians at the time thought, well, he wasn't going to do it here. He was part of a London gang, so what do we really worry about? And then Canadians woke up on June 2nd, 2006, to find that 17 people had been arrested in Toronto, the so-called Toronto 18. The 18th person was arrested 2 months later. And they were Canadians, and they were plotting it here in Canada. So the Toronto 18 had chosen three targets. One, the CSIS building in Toronto. Second, the Toronto Financial District. And third, at military base, which was never identified, but was probably Trenton, which is where the Canadian forces left for their mission in Afghanistan. They had three trucks. They had 3 tons of ammonium nitrate, which, of course, had been substituted by the law enforcement. It wasn't actually a bomb-making material. But I think what surprised Canadians were that they were either born and or raised in this country. They were all from the greater Toronto area, and their radicalization took place entirely within Canada. And you had a variety of immigrants, born Canadians. You had a number of converts in the case. You had 5 young offenders under the age of 18 who had to be treated specially. And so what happened is they got arrested, but in given the justice system in Canada, it took some time for the trials to come. And within months of the 18 being arrested, in 7 cases, the charges were stayed, which means the Crown dropped the charges, which led people to say, how serious is this plot? These are just misguided youth. They're stupid.
Sure.
You had a CSIS / RCMP agent who went public. Therefore, he cajoled them. He influenced them. It was like an agent provocateur, a sting situation. And so there's a lot of skepticism about the case in Canada and whether or not it really was a serious threat to national security. In the end, all 11 who went to trial either pleaded guilty or were found guilty. So, like, again, it showed that the law was applicable in a Canadian setting. But I think most Canadians saw it as a one-off. Okay, we've had our terrorism case now. No one died. Nothing went boom. We're okay. So then, I guess, fast forward 2010. We had a trio from Ottawa who were going to build IEDs. One of the members had trained in Afghanistan, and he had brought instructions back with him. So that case went to court. One guilty, one pleaded guilty, one found guilty, and one was acquitted. Again, nothing happened. So you have the Via Passenger plot, nothing happened. You had the Victoria Day, Canada Day plot in Victoria, nothing happened. And I think Canadians were becoming complacent that, okay, these are just, you know, CSIS is pushing the envelope here. They are infiltrating agents into this. And in fact, it's the agents that are urging these people to carry out attacks. On their own, they wouldn't do this. Well, then again, until we had last October. And in the span of 2 days, we had 2 attacks resulting in 2 deaths. So warrant officer Patrice Vincent in Montreal was run down. And 2 days later, on the National War Memorial in Ottawa, Corporal Nathan Cirillo, who was an honor guard at the Cenotaph, was shot dead by Michael's Unhappy Boat. That was the wake-up call, I think, for Canadians. Now we have a case that's not just theoretical. We don't have a case of, you know, agents monitoring people or, you know, providing intelligence to the security forces. We have 2 individuals radicalized entirely within Canada who chose to punish Canada and Canadians for our decision to send aircraft to Iraq to join in the coalition fight against the Islamic State. And because we're doing that, we're killing Muslims. We deserve to be punished. And that's why 2 members of the military, in fact, were probably targeted. They were symbolic. They were in uniform. And it was the Canadian military that's being sent by the government to carry out these attacks. Canada, I'm not going to, that wasn't our 9/11. I don't want to use that term. And it's not merely because, it was only 2 deaths versus 3,000 deaths. I don't want to get into the numbers here. But I think in a lot of ways, some of the innocence was lost that day. And a lot of what the security services and government's been saying for years is that it's not a matter of if, it's a matter of when, unfortunately happened a year ago. And Canadians, I think, are now living a different reality. Unfortunately, in some cases, some of the messaging coming out isn't helpful by certain politicians, but that's a whole other issue we might get into later on. I also talk a lot about the so-called foreign fighters. So we've had a number of Canadians who traveled abroad to join terrorist groups. The Jabara brothers from an industrial city called St. Catharines in the province of Ontario went to join Al-Qaeda. One died in a firefight in Saudi Arabia. The other unsuccessfully carried out an attack in Southeast Asia, is now serving a life sentence in New York. We have had other people join. We had two young men from my hometown, London, Ontario, went and joined Al-Qaeda in Islamic Maghreb in 2013. And they died in the attack on a gas plant in southeastern Algeria, which resulted in the death of 44 gas workers. We've had other people join the Islamic State. We've had people join Al-Shabaab and died. We had a kid who was a boxer join rebels in Dagestan and was killed by Russian special forces. So it seems like there's been Canadians here and Canadians there. And in some cases, the terrorist groups are using Canadians as their poster children. And to me, the greatest example of that is a young man called André Poulin, who's from a town called Timmins, Ontario, which happens to be Shania Twain's hometown. And he died in Syria a year and a half ago, fighting with the Islamic State. And the video that he gives about why he joined, and more importantly, he kind of talks posthumously after he's been killed about the greatness of the Islamic State, is one of the most professional videos I've seen come out from these guys. And it's this young Canadian from a town in nowhere, Ontario, and he became a hero, became great. He left his past, he left this small town mentality, he joined the Islamic State, and now he's a martyr. So there are ample cases over the past, let's say, 10 to 15 years that show that Canadians and Canada is not immune to this radical ideology, and that you know, the security service tell us there's several hundred that they're aware of, and there's undoubtedly more than that. Some of them are playing major roles in propaganda, in recruiting, and the unfortunate reality is that I don't think this is going to end anytime soon.
Given that we're faced with some potentially detectable behaviors, which you outline in your book, that might allow authorities to intervene in the radicalization process, what preventative measures or strategies does your study recommend? I know in Canada there's been a lot of debate around this with bills C-44 and C-51. What are your thoughts on that subject?
This is a tough one. There's a lot of thought being given into what do we do. So the counterterrorism response is a spectrum, all the way from what's called early intervention to investigation, arrest, charging, and incarceration. And both sides have to apply depending on the case. Instinctively, because I don't know of any study that shows this, but instinctively, if you're going to intervene and get someone to abandon the ideology, it has to happen early. So once they're just dipping their toe into the violent waters, if you will, once they get a little more well-versed in the ideology, or they develop relationships with other extremists, it becomes harder because they're further into the world and it's harder to bring them back out. I don't have any statistics to give you. I don't have any models to share with you on that. I don't think there are any. It's more just a sort of a gut feeling this is the way it has to be. So there are some strategies going on right now. The city of Calgary just announced their redirect program last week, which is an early intervention strategy. So when people are starting to exhibit the behaviors, be they attitudinal or behaviors, that something has to be done, whether it's mentoring, whether it's religious instruction, whether there's other problems. Maybe there might be a family problem, might be a learning problem, might be a mental problem. So the theory is address those problems and you might address the radicalization problem. It's a great idea. Intervention is a heck of a lot cheaper than investigation. Major investigations cost hundreds of millions of dollars. Intervention does not cost that much. So I'm a huge advocate for trying intervention with the proviso or with the warning that it's not always going to work, and that people who don't respond to intervention unfortunately have to be sort of thrown back into that pool where you're looking at investigation either by the security service or law enforcement, and possibly ending up with charges being laid at some point. I'm not a believer in counter-radicalization, to be perfectly honest. I'm not a believer in counter-narratives. I think that we need to tell our own stories and not sort of counter the Islamic State word for word, phrase by phrase. I think that gives them far too much credence, and we should simply ignore what they're saying and tell our own story. It's not a surprise people want to come to Canada. They want to come to the United States. And we're lands of opportunity. We're lands of immigrants. We have our own story to tell. It's a successful story. Why not just, you know, rather than nitpick what the Islamic State or Al-Qaeda is saying, just say, here's who we are, here's what we stand for, and here's what you can achieve by becoming a citizen of our countries. At the end of the day, you're going to have the hard end, which is basically your investigation and your arrests, which leads to charges, trials, and convictions, which leads to incarceration. That's a whole other world that, at least in Canada, we've sort of dodged that bullet. We don't have a huge prison radicalization problem. I used to work with Correctional Services Canada. They've done their own studies, and they've shown it. It really isn't the problem it is in France or the UK or the United States, for example. And I think that's simply it's a numbers game. We've only incarcerated a couple dozen people. The French have incarcerated hundreds, if not thousands. So you don't have the critical mass there to act as a radicalization incubator for other inmates. It's not to say it's not there at all, but it certainly isn't the endemic problem it is in other countries. So I think that your counterterrorism strategy has to include all of those. Identify people early enough, try to get them off the path, all the way up to investigation and laying of charges. And again, the problem is there's no predictive mechanism to say this guy will respond to intervention, whereas that guy is going to go straight to investigation.
Rounding off the discussion of the book, can you address where you see this phenomenon of so-called lone wolves going in the medium term?
I've given talks on radicalization around the world over the past 15 years, and I used to start off my talk saying that this phenomenon had 20 to 50 years left. Now that it's 10 years later, I'm saying it has 10 to 40. I don't think it's going away, and it's not going away for a variety of reasons. One is that conflict will always be there. And we've seen historically the Afghan conflict, which was kind of, in a way, was the birth mother, if you will, of a lot of this stuff. That's never went away, and this is 30 years later, and it's still going on. You've seen Somalia, which is basically a failed state since the early 90s. That's not going away, despite African Union forces and things like that. Iraq has gone from stable dictatorship to complete mess under the U.S. invasion 2003 to kind of better into now a complete morass with the U.S. troop withdrawal and the division within Iraqi society. Syria, it's a hellhole, and it's going to be that way for a very long time. The Balkans are starting to raise their ugly head again in terms of some very worrisome Muslim on non-Muslim acrimony within Serbian and Croatian society, Bosnian society, the Caucasus, Dagestan, Chechnya, and there are a bunch of smaller ones that no one talks about. The persecution of Muslims in Myanmar by the Buddhists, the war in southern Thailand, which may have led, in fact, to a bombing a month ago in Bangkok. We have tension in India, not just in the Kashmir region between Pakistan and India, but within Indian society itself. We've got, of course, West Africa with Boko Haram in northern Nigeria, now spreading into Cameroon, now spreading into Senegal, now spreading into Mali and Niger. So these are all conflicts that are going to sort of play themselves out over years, if not decades. The message and the appeal that the groups are putting out doesn't seem to be waning either. People have talked about the brutality of the Islamic State, you know, burning people alive, beheading people on camera, throwing people off buildings. As how could anyone see any value in any of that? And I don't understand it either. What I do understand is that there's no ebb to the flow of Westerners fighting for the Islamic State. So they're going there for some reason. And it's actually the book I'm writing right now is talking about that. Why are they going? What are their motivations? Why do they make these decisions? And unfortunately, we have politicians who make asinine statements. We've heard in the U.S. Republican candidates just in the past couple of days. Donald Trump talks about he won't challenge the notion that President Obama is a Muslim. We had Ben Carson say that a Muslim shouldn't be president. We've had incidents here in Canada where we had a candidate in Toronto say he doesn't want refugees to come here because he doesn't want us to become like Europe. And they're entitled to their opinions. It's not illegal. It's free speech. But what message are we giving there? Well, we're giving the message that the Muslims who live in our societies don't really belong here. The infamous niqab debate, now which the government wants to take to the Supreme Court. You know, I don't like the niqab any more than most people do, but is it my business to say whether you should wear it? I don't think so. You can wear a Mickey Mouse hat in your head for all I care. So I think that there's an atmosphere of intolerance, much worse in Europe than it is in North America. We're seeing the rise of political on the political right, far-right parties in Europe, anti-immigration, anti-Muslim, which is very worrisome. So I think that the combination of foreign conflicts, the appeal of the terrorist groups, and a growing intolerant fringe to society in the West will all contribute to future jihads, future people radicalizing.
I don't want to take up much more of your time, but before we go, perhaps you could tell us what projects are next for you. You alluded to another book in the works.
So when I worked with the government, I had all these ideas. And of course, as I said, when you work in a classified environment, you can't do anything with them. So I, in fact, have a number of books that I am working on simultaneously. So I'm hoping to have a manuscript done by the end of this year. And it's looking at the foreign fighter phenomenon. Not from the perspective of who's going and where they're going, what they're doing. I'm looking at why. I'm actually going to try to answer the question why, which I couldn't answer in my first book. And what I'm using is basically the words of the people themselves. So their explanations for why they left. And I'm going to focus on the Islamic State only because it's such a huge phenomenon right now. As I said, estimates of 20 to 30,000 foreigners are fighting with the Islamic State. So there's plenty of ground for that. What I'm hoping to show is that the reasons why people leave to join the Islamic State are not necessarily any different why people join militaries and fight in wars to begin with. So the book's not finished yet, but I'm already seeing, you know, why do people volunteer for the armed forces? A sense of loyalty, a sense of nationalism, a sense of thrill, a sense of adventure, a sense of camaraderie. It's a job, right? It's something to do. And I'm seeing already that those things, plus some other ones that don't tend to occur, like religious reasons and things like that, but there is some commonality for why people fight. So that's the book I'm hoping to have out then. In the future, I want to look at those lesser-known conflicts that people aren't talking about. I want to look at Myanmar. I want to look at southern Thailand, Sri Lanka. There's been some Buddhist and Muslim violence in Sri Lanka. And the question I want to ask is, what would it take for those conflicts to become major conflicts? So you look back to Afghanistan in 1979. So the Soviets invaded, big deal. They invaded all kinds of places, you know, during their existence. Why did this one become the great jihad? And there are a number of sort of one-off factors. You know, the presence of Abdullah Azzam, the presence of Osama bin Laden, U.S. support for the Mujahideen, the particular brutality. So there's all kinds of things. So the question I'm asking is, what would it take for conflicts like what we have now to become major conflicts? And then I want to write a book basically on religious hatred across the spectrum. I want to look at, you know, why the Islamic State has so much hate for non-Muslims. But look at other, you know, we have Buddhist hatred, we have Hindu hatred, we have Christian hatred, we have Jewish hatred. What is it that drives people to target people because of the difference in religion? And then eventually, at some point, the grand opus will be looking at what does all this mean? We've been fighting terrorism for millennia. This particular brand of terrorism, which is called a religious wave of terrorism after David Rappaport, the U.S. scholar, seems to have some legs. It seems to be, it'll be going on for quite some time. Where is it going? How are we doing? What are we doing right? What are we doing wrong? What can we do better? And, you know, where are we going to end up in 50 years' time? So definitely lots of projects on the go and lots of time to do them, hopefully.
Fantastic. Well, we hope to have you back for future episodes of New Books in National Security. Thanks so much, Bill.
Thank you very much.
Such a pleasure to talk with you today.